Glasses, featuring the Shell gas station on Highway 98 in Daphne and in Malbus with a state-of-the-art car wash and by an anonymous sponsor. Well, good morning, Deke. How are you, sir?
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
Doing good. Doing good.
Happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, too.
Yes, sir. So, folks, before we introduce our special guest for today, just want to go over a few headlines in the news and the big one that is kind of lurking beneath the surface is the closure of the Babau Mindab shipway, throughway, the Red Sea, leading up to the Suez Canal, and that impacts about 15% of the world's maritime commerce. And so this has direct implications for the Port of Alabama and all East Coast ports, because we do receive, we're kind of like a secondary. The first impacted would be, of course, Europe, because so much of their traffic comes right up out of the Suez Canal right there by Egypt and then up into the southern European ports and then on over to France and the UK, et cetera. But secondarily, you know, we receive a fair amount of our commerce through the Babau Mindab throughway from India. You know, India increasingly supplies more products to the United States, and yes, some of those do enter right here at the Port of Alabama. And so overnight, well, in the last couple of nights, we've seen container shipping prices jump to $10,000 per container, and that is almost a 5x increase. And then, you know, we add on top of that, there's some opportunism going on out there in the market, and you know, you've got some, like, for instance, some of the brokerage companies out of India, you know, they haven't quite gone to $10,000 per container, but where it might have been $1,800 to $2,000 even, you know, 3-4 weeks ago, it's jumped to $7,000. And so, you know, per container. And that's the Connex boxes that you see, you know, coming in on the Maersk container ships and the HPAG Lloyd and all those vessels into the Port of Alabama. And so when we look at the long term implications of that, especially as we just recover from the absolute insane problems that we had coming out of COVID with supply chain issues and inflation, where we just seem to have gotten those tamed, right, in the last several months. We're looking at, you know, easily a new round of inflation. And the longer that this boils on, it's a real problem, because you've got, you know, real issues with, you know, those prices being pushed over onto the consumer. So because it just doesn't impact the price of container shipping. It, you know, many of those suppliers will now push their commerce over onto aircraft. And, you know, Maersk has diversified their supply chains over the last couple of years, having learned lessons from COVID. And they now have reserved cargo space on large, you know, 767s, 777s, 380s, that kind of thing. And so they can ship airborne, but that's really expensive. And that's going to, of course, have a pass-down effect to you know, your average citizen. So as we look at this, folks, you know, we have to look at the root cause. And you know us, we're not here grinding the axe on grievances, right? We try and recommend, make sound recommendations so that you, our listeners, can, you know, get on the phone with our elected representatives and others that you know, and, you know, especially within your own influence networks and your professional networks and, you know, your families around the holidays, and talk about these issues, you know, because they're so important. They affect not just the pocketbooks of families, but then also jobs and our ability to maintain, you know, demand and balance in our economy. And so when we look at the root causes of this, none of this needed to happen. You know, the Houthi rebels, which are Iranian-backed, are the ones who are causing this problem as they sit there off the tip of Yemen and lob anti-ship cruise missiles and other things, you know, more and more at, you know, at merchant ships and U.S. Navy destroyers. Go ahead, Mark, what you got?
Well, I saw the video the other day. They didn't just lob missiles. They actually landed a helicopter on board one of the ships and captured the ship. I mean, that's that's like a whole step up. What kind of implications does that mean, and how do we challenge that?
Well, exactly. So that is a tried and true tactic perfected by the Quds forces and the Iranian Revolutionary Guards in the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Hormuz, over the last several decades, where they will get very aggressive with commercial shippers. And what they'll do, it's piracy, right? Straight up, it's,
right,
piracy.
It's piracy.
But because people fear Iran in that part of the world, and especially their militias, they will never push back too hard, except for us and maybe a few of our allies, push back too hard against things like that, which are direct boardings, what we call non-compliant boardings, where Iran will either send out fast attack craft, maritime craft, you know, small boats, and then basically hold a ship and its captain and its crew hostage until the company pays. And if the and if it's a nation state, that a flag state that has the flag on that, you know, the registry for that vessel, they may hold out until the country pays, you know. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lucrative business for them. It generates serious hard currency.
Sure.
You know, when you're sitting there, my goodness, when I was building a drill ship over in Korea back about 6-7 years ago, we had the world's largest, some of the largest world's largest cargo vessels, CGA, CGM, Chinese shipper, mm-hmm. you know, on bigger than even Maersk. But they were building a massive, the world's largest container ship ever built was being built right there at Samsung Heavy Shipyards in South Korea. And so that vessel, just to build that, is upwards of $1 billion. And then fully equipped, it's over that. And so when you can hold that type, you know, that asset hostage. And
it's not just the containers on the ship, it's
right.
the ship itself.
That's right. It's the ship, it's the crew, and every day that thing is waylaid, you know, and sequestered, it's not out there making money for the
right.
owners. And so it's a real problem, but it's a problem in leadership, and this intensified overnight, and this is the root of the problem, and this is what we need to engage our representatives on. The root of the problem is that we had put together a coalition to basically protect shipping in that area. It's not the first time we've ever done this. Okay, we often do this in times of conflict and strife with our European allies, NATO especially. And so we were setting up a task force. We could only muster 10 nations. So this is, it's also telling that we can only muster 10 nations to put forces or commit to being part of this Guardian effort. And the real problem with this is a failure of U.S. leadership, especially at the State Department, within the U.S. Department of Defense, and within the U.S. administration. And so when we look at what we can do on this issue, we need to make sure that we're contacting our representatives and insisting on the Secretary of the Navy, Carlos Del Toro, taking charge of this effort, because last night the French walked out. And when the French walk out of a effort, they have one of the most robust navies in Europe, and certainly the best positioned within Southern Europe and the Mediterranean Sea, and closest to the Suez Canal, to have an immediate impact. And logistically, if you're trying to support an operation like this, and I've done many of these over the years, you know that it's really a challenge when you've got your number one, you know, player that contributes as forces and logistics pull out of the effort. It's a real problem. And so they pulled out, and you know, so that left nine, and then you've got two more that really have no forces, and so you can see quickly where it begins to wither away. And that's just a absolute failure of leadership. And so we need to contact our elected representatives and tell them that, you know, Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Secretary of Transportation, has absolutely no business nor expertise running this effort. He doesn't know what he's doing. He never served in the military. They, under the Obama administration and then the current administration, they have only ravaged the U.S. Maritime Administration, which is also in charge of a lot of maritime shipping and activity around our ports, and would certainly, along with the U.S. Coast Guard and the U.S. Navy, take the lead on this issue. This administration, the current administration, has zero expertise in naval affairs and maritime affairs on its staff. The last administration had three shippers, people who actually owned ships and had interest, and they understood the problem,
mm-hmm.
on the cabinet. Whereas now, you know, we have absolutely zero representation in this administration. And as we talk about, you know, Southwest Alabama and how big this port is to our economy, it's really important that we realize the disaster that's unfolding right in real time in front of our eyes. This has long-term implications. It's not just inflation and jobs locally, but then it's also it hastens the decline of the U.S. dollar in trade, and so it's a real problem. So again, folks, you know, read up on it. There's a great article if you search up, as my boys say, on Google or Metagur or any of your other search engines. Go to gcaptain.com, and they are kind of a commercial newsletter or digital publication that documents well this issue and just the ongoing ramifications of the problem, and then they also make some timely recommendations. But when we engage with our legislators on this issue, because many people are not well versed in this issue, you know, we do need to give them the meat. And so go to gcaptain.com and pull that article and maybe see if you can find any others out there. But it's absolutely preventable, and this did not need to happen. And so stand by for heavy rolls, as we say in the Navy, because it's going to get worse here in first quarter 24. Okay, folks, so one of the other big issues that hit the news, and we're going to talk about this on the back end if we have time. If not, we'll cover it next week's show, is that Dr. William Mackus, who we've talked about on this show before, you know, writes a article called a daily newsletter called COVID Intel. And he's a oncologist and radiologist up in Alberta, Canada. And he has been at the forefront, the cutting edge of reporting from non-standard, non-traditional sources on excess deaths related to the COVID vaccines. And so in our Health Freedom Minute, I just wanted to also point our listeners to today's publication. Actually, sorry, it was 2 days ago, from Dr. Mackus, where he reveals U.S. military deaths and military deaths worldwide from these excess deaths. And this is something that we've had whispers of that have been going on, including the heart attack mid-flight up at Fort Rucker, where, you know, just a few months ago, where the young chief warrant officer, had a heart attack behind the controls of a helicopter during training in flight, and the pilot instructor had to actually take control of the aircraft and land it, and the student pilot under instruction was dead for 18 minutes before they revived him, and he did live. But this is just an example of how dangerous this is. We talked about the aviation deaths last week, and then, you know, just a couple days ago, we get this publication from Dr. Mackus on U.S. military deaths, and it's stunning when we look at it, because at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, within 8 days, so last Saturday, December 16th, a young 30-year-old drill sergeant, drill instructor at basic training there in Fort Jackson, was found dead in his car. 30 years old. Okay, 8 days prior to that, on December 8th, a 34-year-old young Army drill instructor, another one, was found dead in his quarters, did not report for work. Let me tell you something, folks, this is highly unusual, highly irregular. These are some of the healthiest of the healthy, the 1% of our population. And when we look even back 6 months ago, there was another reported death at Fort Jackson. Okay, and so that's just one base within one military department within the last several months, and just two deaths in 8 days. And how many more are we not hearing about? And then we talked about last week how, you know, a young lieutenant named Ted Macy in the Navy Medical Service Corps came out unofficially and talked about the 1,000% increase in heart attacks among pilots, both fixed wing and rotary pilots in the military. That's crazy. 1,000% increase year over year from 2022 to 2023. And now, you know, this piece that Dr. Mackus published a few days ago, he details from non-traditional sources 45 sudden deaths among military personnel, most of them U.S. military. And so it's a real problem, and we need to continue to assert our rights, our liberty and our freedoms within the health freedom movement, and insist on answers, because the government doesn't care. It's very clear at this point to anybody who's been paying attention that the U.S. government is trying to kill people, and it's hard to get your head around. It's very hard to get your head around. But you can't look at this and see the hundreds of thousands of excess deaths now into the millions just in the United States from the COVID vaccine, and the statistical correlation is 100%. There's no question whatsoever that these vaccines are killing far more people than the supposed COVID virus ever did. And so now we really need to be demanding answers on, you know, autopsies and at the local level. And so with that, we're going to segue into our local circuit clerk race and introduce Brenda Ganey, who is our acting circuit court for Baldwin County. Good morning, Brenda.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm doing good today. Thanks for having me.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you so much for coming on the show. So, Brenda, tell us about yourself.
I was born and raised here in Baldwin County. I attended Baldwin County High School. My husband and I both did and graduated. Shortly thereafter, about a year after we graduated from high school, we were married. So we've been married for 47 years. We have two sons. My oldest son, Lance, is a graphic designer and head of the graphics department for the Mississippi Healthcare Centers. His wife is Erin Dean, who owns a family plant nursery over in Hurley, Mississippi. Mm-hmm. And so we've got a group in Mississippi. My youngest son is married to a Jefferson County. They live in Birmingham. She teaches drama theater. Mm-hmm. And they have our two grandchildren up there. He is the CFO for the American Village in Montevallo, Alabama. And our grandchildren, we just sent them home yesterday after keeping them for a week, and we enjoyed having them down here. Mm-hmm. But I, shortly after I graduated high school, started working in the circuit clerk's office and worked there. I retired with over 25 years. It was right at 27 years experience in the clerk's office. But I've worked in the court system for over 40 years. When I retired, I went to work for our judges as the Baldwin County Court Administrator, and I coordinated the courtrooms in the Fairhope, Foley, and the Bay Minette offices. I also worked for about 2.5 years in Montgomery at the Administrative Office of Courts, and did basically...
So state level.
State level.
Okay.
And I did in Montgomery what I did on a daily basis in Baldwin County, except it was times 67. I helped all the other counties if they had issues with their maintenance screens or with their accounting, their bank reconciliations. I also helped with... implementing the legislature would pass new acts that would either put new restrictions or new tasks on our laws. Mm-hmm. Would pass new laws that affected the judicial system, and it was my responsibility to make sure that the programmers received instructions on how to update our computer systems. Mm-hmm. So that we could ensure we were collecting the correct fees. Yeah. Or that our maintenance screens had the fields needed to put that information in so it could be monitored.
So compliance.
For compliance with, yeah, the law. Yes, sir. Yeah. So I've been in and out of the court system for over 40 years. Mm-hmm. And I love Baldwin County, even though...
On the right side of the court system.
On the right side of the court system. And I tell people, most of the people that come into the circuit clerk's office, they're mad. Because they're not happy to be there. They've either had a complaint filed against them, or they want to file a complaint against somebody. Mm-hmm. So the clerk's office cannot give them legal advice. We're not attorneys, and by the law, we cannot tell them what they're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. But we try to be compassionate, and we try to point and steer them in the right direction so that they know where they can go seek help. We give them numbers, and we can't give them names of attorneys, but we can tell them if they don't have the money for an attorney, we can give them the legal service number over in Mobile. I think that's where their office is located at now. Mm-hmm. Is they closed the one that they had in Baldwin County, but we can give them out that information. If we have forms, we can tell them, we can give them the forms and ask that they fill those forms out. The only happy people that come in our office are people that are coming to apply for passports. Even our jurors, when they get a jury summons and report for jury duty, sometimes they're not too happy to be there. But most of the time, once they come and they serve, they find out it's very enjoyable to see it and just to see what the judicial system
does. Be part of the process.
Because that is their first contact with the courts. That's the only dealings that they've ever had with the system, and it just makes a big difference for them to come in and see how the judicial system works.
So, thank you. So it's, and I would agree, jury duty was certainly my first contact with the courts, right? Like I was, you know, really surprised by that process, and it's a little laborious, can be, right? Depending on the scale and scope of the case and which court, you know, is being tried in. But, you know, as you alluded to, Brenda, you know, it's the circuit court, the clerk of court is often the first touchstone that the average citizen, the average law-abiding citizen has with any elected office or government representative, right? Like it's really the first time that they even have anything. So it's very important, certainly as I would see it, that we have
their first contact.
Your first
We're
contact,
the first
right.
people that they call our names when they receive a summons or a notice from the court. It has the circuit clerk's office name, usually my name or the circuit clerk's name on it, and a contact number.
Yep.
And so we're the office they're going to call. We're the people they're going to talk to. And that's one of the things that I changed when I was appointed. Our calls used to be handled through the Citizen Service Center that is managed by the county. And it was good. It freed our employees up to be able to do other duties. But at the same time, citizens were having to tell a story two or three times maybe before they would even get to speak to an employee in the circuit clerk's office. So when I was appointed, I rerouted all of our phone calls so that now when you call one of our direct call numbers, it comes directly to our office, so that if that person that answers the phone can't help you, they can transfer you to that department and you're not having to tell a story over and over again, because we need to be there for the people, and we need to be able to answer their questions as quickly and as efficiently as possible so that they can get the help they need.
Yeah. So, how large is your staff? What size is your staff?
I have currently have 23 employees. I have 24. One is leaving December the 31st after 25 years of service. She's retiring. And then I recently lost another employee. She had a family emergency, and she had to return back to Tennessee, move back to Tennessee. So I am down to 23 employees. Two of those are in Fairhope, and two of them are in Foley. And then the other employees are in Bay Minette. So
it's interesting, because I know I always prefer speaking to a caring human being, a live caring human being, especially on such matters of import. And so, you know, you talk about your satellite offices, and that, because that has been a problem over the years, right? Where Bay Minette is way, I mean, we're such a large county, you know, Bay Minette's way up in North County. And so if you live down in Orange Beach or Gulf Shores, you know, it's a half day to a full day.
It's
right?
Lot easier to get to Foley than it is to Bay Minette.
Yes, it is. So of your 23 reps in your office, you have, and it's four?
It's four, right. Two in Fairhope and two in Foley. There was five, but one of the employee that had a family emergency was in Fairhope.
Right.
And so we are looking to replace that person just as quickly as we can find someone, because that we need to have someone who can float between those two offices to keep them manned. Now, is it going to stay that many? Probably not. Over the next 2 years, we're looking at a lot of changes. We're also going to be moving from our upstairs office. I had combined all the offices into one office, and they thought they would be able to renovate the downstairs area for a courtroom for our new judges that are coming in. Well, it turns out, because of the foundation and support walls and a bunch of stuff that I really don't understand, that they can't convert it into a courtroom because it obstructs the view to the bench and to the witness box. It also will not accommodate a jury box downstairs. So we are going to move downstairs, because our offices will fit in that area, and they will be able to mirror our courtroom one that is downstairs in Bay Minette into the area that is currently our office upstairs. So so sometime in the next year, and I look for it to be probably early next year, we will be moving into the downstairs area. They're going to renovate it and fix it for us so that it will accommodate my office downstairs.
Right. So those are near-term renovations
Yes.
that are certainly going to support the clerk
Yes.
and the staff.
It's gonna involve a complete out of the box thinking. I'm gonna have to look at the duties and the different areas that each office handles. Mm-hmm. Right now, we have 9 divisions of court. And, of course, we have our family court, which is the JU, the juvenile division, the child support divisions, and the domestic relations. Mm-hmm. Our new circuit judge will be a family court judge, so we definitely know. And our staff may have to move depending on where the judges decide that judge needs to be located. If she is going to be in a satellite, then we may need to look at moving those employees more, geared them more in the satellite courthouses rather than in the Baymanette mm-hmm. courthouses. We're also getting a new district judge, mm-hmm. and if he is in Baymanette, then we may need to, if he starts holding, right now we do not have traffic court in the Baymanette area. If he moves to, if he is placed in Baymanette, then there's possibility we may have to increase our DR, our district court traffic. I'm so used to using, you're gonna have to excuse
the acronyms.
Me
that's okay
I'm
it's
so
okay.
used to using the acronyms
right.
But we may have to look at, just think outside the box and reestablish the duties in our office so that we can accommodate.
Right.
Of course, we need employees, but it's hard to find employees right now because there's just not enough people applying. So if anybody's out there and are interested in a career with the court system, please get in contact with me. I'd love to hear from them.
That's fantastic. I mean, it's interesting, too, just as a footnote. 2 weeks ago, we heard one of our circuit judges, give us an update at the Baldwin County Roundtable over at Mama Lou's, and it was interesting just to hear his reflections on where their caseload is right now. And so part of it is, you know, the appointment of the family court judge and the new circuit judge, but you know, it's stunning when you look at a circuit court judge holding somewhere in the neighborhood of 14,000 active cases. You know, and it's, part of it is reflective of growth, of course, mm-hmm. you know, but then you also have these other, you know, breakouts where, like down in South County, they have so many snowbirds and tourists that, you know, they actually try and it's actually, you know, a tactic where they, if they can keep it in local court, they'll write the citations or the summons for mm-hmm. that, right, if there's an infraction, you know. And so, even with those management practices in place, you know, we've got a circuit judge that's carrying nearly 14,000 cases. We wonder, and yeah, and so the implications for that, and we don't need to tell the listeners this, they know it, because, you know, there are times in your life, and hopefully not many, if ever, you know, of course, you know, where, you know, things, people hit difficulties, and you know, it may be a divorce, or it may be something where they have to be in court for some, you know, it may be a business issue. But when those issues bubble up to that level of the judiciary, and there's that kind of backlog, it's a real, I mean, it stresses people out to no end, because especially, for instance, in domestic matters, they feel like they just can't get on with their lives. And you know, it could be that somebody made a mistake, and they
exactly.
realize it, and they're, you know, they you know, they're going to go, and they're going to you know, listen to whatever the court, you know, court's judgment is on that. But you know, it just, the whole thing, when we see these things run out at a year and a half or 2 years before they actually see the courtroom for adjudication, it's
a
real problem.
And we're hoping that the new judge, that should decrease some of that, those times, the wait time to actually go to trial
mm-hmm.
with the new family court judge that's going to be taking the bench. Referee Kemp has no opposition, so we know that she will be the judge that will be taking the bench, but we don't know yet exactly where she's going to be located.
She's at a Spanish Fort. She's Spanish Fort. I think she's Spanish Fort. But
yeah.
Yep.
Spanish Fort Fairhope.
Yep.
She has actually has a works with a firm here in Fairhope.
Okay. Yeah.
But yeah, she's from the Spanish Fort area, well, Fish River maybe.
Okay.
Area.
Right.
Yeah.
Long experience.
Yeah. She has been in our court system almost as long as I have. She started out at the DA's office, mm-hmm. and so she has a lot of experience with the court system. But I'm looking forward to her coming on board. She's already the referee, mm-hmm. so we're already working with her on the referee cases. And so she's already familiar with our office. Our staff is already familiar with her and how she enters the order. So we're already working well with Mrs. Kemp. So
yeah, I think she's going to be a very quick study.
I think she is. She is very quick.
Yes.
So
that's good. But, so